Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And this is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White. This is a special series of What's Next where we are discussing the Heritage Foundation's Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise Project 2025. I am joined by Will Green, the Director of Outreach and Community Engagement at the University at Buffalo's School of Education. Will, thanks for being on with us again.
Yep. Thank you. Glad to be here. That's Assistant Dean.
Assistant Dean.
Yep.
All right. All right. So Will, what is Project 2025 and how does it align with a possible second term for former President Donald Trump?
So before we get into how it aligns with the potential second term for Donald Trump, I think we need to talk about kind of contextually what this initiative is born out of. Of course, it's born out of the initial Trump presidency. But I think for our listeners and folks who I represent within the community, I think we have to talk about January 6th. I don't think we can talk about a potential second Trump term. I don't think we can talk about the ideologies that exist within Project 2025 without at first acknowledging what happened on January 6th.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about January 6th then.
All right. Well, I think some of the image is stark, right?
Mm-hmm.
A mob attempted to disrupt political process through force. There's no other way to explain it. Now, I think the question in a lot of people's minds is that how can someone who seemed to be a key central figure in Donald Trump, who was a part of that, now be up for election for another presidential term?
Right. Doesn't seem possible that could happen.
It seems completely outlandish that we can see people in the name of Donald Trump storm the Capitol, kill an officer, enter the Capitol, and have feet up on desk and make claims of an overthrow. We had political figures who had to be hidden for fear of being killed. And just before, we know Donald Trump was not there. He was not pushing at the gates. But the rhetoric that was spewed prior to that happening came directly from his mouth. So there has to be a lot of people in America who are wondering, how on earth can someone who contributes to those conditions now be up for election in a presidential campaign?
What does that say about our political system that, you know, given the rhetoric that Donald Trump was spewing in the days, the weeks, the months leading up to and after the election, leading up to January 6th, that he is now the ordained, I mean, he's been the ordained front runner since Biden was inaugurated.
So I think there's historical precedent. First of all, we have to acknowledge that the criminal justice system, for whatever reasons, has had tremendous difficulty holding white folks accountable for violence toward black communities and other communities. So it's a system that has historically, we can see historically, I mean, we can trace back.
As an aside, when you talk about violence, and I think a lot of people have this narrow view of violence that is in the physical sense, but you are talking about a broader view of violence.
Absolutely. Political violence does not have to mean bloodshed. It can be policy. It can be strategies implemented to disenfranchise people that ultimately leads to physical damage. If we look at Reconstruction, this is exactly what happened during Reconstruction. In the South, Southerners were quite upset that they lost power. You had a number of democratically elected officials who were of color, who were black, who were siding and connecting across party lines with white politicians to change things in the South. And you had violent rebellions in which black politicians were removed from those seats and those institutions were taken over. And unfortunately, during that time, the federal government gave in to that type of violence and terrorism in the South. And that's how we got Jim Crow laws and segregation. So there's precedent for these things happening, and there was no prosecution of individuals. And anybody can go on to any web-based platform and research Reconstruction and to see what happened to a lot of these folks and a lot of the laws that were put in place to make an equal playing field for black folks.
And as another quick aside, Michael Harriott from The Griot was recently on a MSNBC podcast talking about exactly that, what happened during Reconstruction and how that plays into what we're seeing now.
Yeah. And, you know, so for me, being armed with that information, that historical perspective, to see the incidents on January 6th, it was literally like, I've seen this before. I've heard of this before. And I think for a number of black people, we were not surprised by what we saw. I think there are folks who were surprised by the lack of ability to hold those folks accountable, which gets us to your question of, well, what does it mean for Donald Trump to be in this seat again? There are certainly communities in America who say, I figured it would be that way.
Exactly. So the Heritage Foundation, who are they? They've been around for 50 years. They are a conservative think tank. And just to put it out there, Donald Trump has disavowed Project 2025. But, and this is a big but.
Right.
140 former Trump administration staffers have helped put this project together that was started in 2022. Let's talk about education. Some of the education, or all of the education principles advocated by Project 2025 are advancing education freedom, providing educational choice for, quote, federal, unquote, children. I would assume that's children who go to public school, restoring state and local control over education funding, treating taxpayers like investors in federal student aid, protecting the student loan portfolio from predatory politicians, safeguarding civil rights, and stopping executive overreach. When you read that list, what are you thinking? What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, Heritage Foundation, as you mentioned, I think founded in 74, the 70s, and a lot of the organizations who have aligned or signed on as partner organizations or just collaborator organizations, they seem to have started in the 70s, which was interesting to me. And you do think about America and what was happening in the 70s. But I'm not surprised because this has been some of the most contemporary sticking points with conservatives and conservative organizations in terms of education. Anti-union, they want to break down the unions. They feel like unions protect individuals who don't have the capacity to do the work. They become administrative blockades to holding schools accountable and teachers accountable. But these are things that I think conservatives have expressed concern about for a number of years. Mm-hmm. So this isn't anything new in terms of the perspective that I'm coming from. I think, you know, when you guys reached out to me and asked, you know, to participate in this discussion, I started to look at Project 2025. And before I talk about that, I have to mention this. Mm-hmm. One of the most powerful tools of racism and white supremacy is the ability to shift our focus onto things that prevent us from using that energy to erect structures and systems to tear down the entire system of racism and white supremacy. So I look at the Heritage Foundation and what they've erected and constructed. And we also have to acknowledge that they are organized.
Very organized.
Very organized. I mean, just reviewing the website, beyond the information about Project 2025, but they have a way to onboard and introduce everyday citizens to the political process. They offer a presidential training academy for those interested in federal and state level government jobs. And you can start to take courses to train for those positions. So the organization of it all, honestly, is impressive. It's impressive. But the strategies have not changed. The strategies or ideologies haven't changed, at least from what I can see. But they have become a bit more organized, which shows me that they've learned lessons from January 6th. So they don't have to do these overt actions that people can call out as violent. And you mentioned that Donald Trump disavowed himself from Project 2025. He also disavowed himself from January 6th. So for what it's worth, it is what it is.
So this is a entire overhaul of the federal government should Project 2025 happen, and it's filling all these positions in federal government, state government, local government with people of this ideology. That's very, very organized, as you said.
It's very organized, and you know, we never want to make the mistake of assuming. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is look at historical record, look at what has happened prior, and look at the issues of today and what conservative groups are really concerned about with the issues of today. I think the scary thing about Project 2025 and its attitude towards education is that if you look at the attitudes towards education and the idea that we remove the Department of Education as a federal system and we bump it down to states' rights. Now, I would hope that the states who have leaned towards equity will continue to do that, but we have no way of knowing. But I think what happens when you mesh the notion of removing a federal oversight system like the Department of Education and you couple that with conservative attitudes towards immigration, does that now mean that those in the United States who are not considered citizens, who choose not to adhere to all the belief systems that American citizens are expected to uphold, and this is through the conservative lens because I'm speculating, would that now mean that we are removing the right to a formal education of everyone in America? Those are some really, really important things to think about as we look at some of the policies that this Project 2025 is saying it will enact. Like I said, I can't say without, you know, or with 100% certainty that, oh, they'll eliminate the right to a free education. But I think you get dangerously close to that when you look at the policies that conservatives have discussed or moved on.
Right. Yeah. And as you mentioned, like, you know, step one, in the education arena for Project 2025 is eliminating the Federal Department of Education. And as you mentioned, some of the ramifications, but who else would be affected from that, from the elimination of the Department of Education, and why?
Well, so it's the elimination of the Department of Education and the elimination of teacher unions, or at least preventing teacher unions from receiving federal funding. So I think we can't say that no one will not be impacted. I know it's a double negative there, but I think it impacts everyone. It impacts everyone. You look at Title I, right?
Yes.
So Title I is a federally funded program, and it's designed to create an equitable education system for impoverished communities, not just urban centers, but rural areas. So what happens when that funding is now wiped away for those impoverished communities? I think one of the things we looked at, or in the information you provided ahead of time, the technological gap.
Right.
There's so many things that could be impacted by this upheaval. It's hard to imagine any part of education that is existing K through 12, even early childhood, that isn't impacted. But all we can do is speculate on what could happen. But if we look at policies, we look at stances on certain things in America, we could dream up some pretty negative impact or negative consequences.
Yeah. And, you know, as you stated earlier, you know, you'd like to think that states that lean more towards equitable education, like New York State, how would they be impacted with this?
So here's the thing. If we take a look at, you know, how they do the maps of where political lines and parties stand.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at New York State, there are a lot fewer blue spots on the map than red spots.
Correct.
Now, of course, that doesn't account for population. But
land doesn't vote.
Exactly. So what happens when it goes down to state levels and now these formerly, I guess you could say to a certain extent, New York State has been a Democratic state in terms of who we select as governor for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But will these communities be emboldened by this legislation if it comes through and we see a shift to a conservative governor? And now I have to speak from my experience as a black man in America and the historical experience of black people in America. And we know that there's a very fine line between these equitable things that have been erected to help us deal with the historical oppression and folks saying, hey, nah, you've had enough. I mean, if we look at DEI, and, you know, for me, DEI is a little bit problematic, but let's talk about it through this lens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just speaking through my personal experience. When I first entered the teaching field, 1998, I was introduced to the profession by informal mentors, not mentors set up by the school system, but teachers, black teachers, Hispanic teachers who had taught in the system for 20, 25 years. And they introduced me to a concept that I didn't even know the name of it until recently, a fugitive pedagogy. It is a way of teaching in which there is a system that you follow, but being concerned with the liberation of the minds of disenfranchised communities, you hold up the system of education that everybody gets, and then you supplement that education for folks who have been disenfranchised by educational systems.
I get that.
Right.
Yeah.
So now fast forward to now, 20, 30 years later, I can see elements of that clandestine approach to education being brought to the forefront through DEI initiatives. But it's only been maybe within the last 5 to 10 years,
yeah,
in which these things have become mainstream. So that's 5 to 10 years that we've actually had the opportunity to provide a viewpoint of education in America that had been, you know, hidden.
Yeah.
And now, in this time, we are faced with a system that is saying, well, we don't need that system of education because it actually teaches things that it does not teach. Actually, the students in which were in my classroom, it actually helped support them cementing facts that they needed to know to do well on standardized tests and other forms of testing. But here we are in that short period of time, half of my lifetime, where we finally gain an inch to share these ideas and help support students so they can know the true history of America, so they can also understand their place in it and what their mission is moving forward. Now we're already looking at what could be the stamping out of it on a federal level.
Right. And we're already seeing it at a state level in states like Florida and Texas.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how would the New York State Department of Education operate without the Federal Education Department?
Well, so number one, if you eliminate Title I funding, you're talking about, I don't know if some of the most impoverished school districts could exist without Title I funding.
Mm-hmm.
So there would absolutely have to be some reaction by state officials to compensate for that loss of funding.
Right. Would it give states more flexibility to create more equitable school districts instead of just throwing federal money at the problem? I'm speaking as a devil's advocate in this case.
Yep, that's me beeping. Let me
You good? You're good.
Turn off my sound here. There you go. So first of all, like throwing money at it, this is money that's needed. I don't know how you can implement, because what is that money used for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the technological divide. That money can be used to provide resources. And let's go back to Title I, 1965. Right.
Yep.
I mean, Lyndon B. Johnson made these concessions because of the blood that was being spilled in the streets. Right. As a part of the Civil Rights Act, like a lot of these initiatives are a civil rights issue.
Right.
And the idea is that, well, we need to balance the scales. I don't know how you improve without those resources. Now, I would say in the communities that I come from, we've been extremely resourceful in the face of having less. What would that mean on a state level? I can only guess, but I can't see just through historical perspective that they're going to keep the system as it is. There would be things that are lost.
Mm-hmm.
There would be things, there's going to have to be cuts. How they compensate for those cuts and come up with a strategy for reducing the impact of inequity that was pretty much born out of, we're talking 1965, we're talking post-white flight, where a ton of resources were taken out of urban centers,
mm-hmm.
right? And brought into the suburbs. So how do we replace that if there is not action by the government to try to balance those scales? I don't know what the state would do. I would imagine that, first of all, they're going to have to figure out just how to balance budgets without federal funding, and then figure out how to be creative to address the inequities that exist in urban centers and rural areas. I don't have a very positive response to that question.
All right, so let's talk about the opposite. Speaking on your experience as New York State Network Regional Director for Youth Success, what have you seen Title I do, and the successes in that area?
So, you know, talking about my role with the Network for Youth Success, the purpose was, and their focus is always extended learning opportunities, and extended learning opportunities happen before school, after school, during the summer. We talk about summer learning loss. We talk about young people in urban and rural communities not having things to do, organized activities to participate in during the summer, and hours in which their parents may even be at work and don't have adult supervision.
Mm-hmm.
So now what we're talking about are young people without the supports, the academic supports to accelerate learning, to catch up, to improve on deficiencies. And we also don't have the means of supervision in the communities for young people to have a relationship with a caring adult. I think in my experience working with after school programs and out of school time programs, we can talk about the numbers. We could talk about how much they impact student learning. But on a ground level, there are a number of individuals who work with students in those capacities that develop strong relationships with students, that encourage students to attend school more regularly. And that's qualitative data that we would never be able to capture. Like, how do we know how much somebody in an after school program who has a positive relationship with a young person encourages them and inspires them to keep pushing through the educational system, and they come out on the opposite end having graduated or just better citizens as a result? We can't capture that, but I certainly think that if we eliminate those opportunities for young people to engage adults in those spaces outside of the structured school system, we will see very quickly what it means to not have caring adults in the lives of students during those times.
As someone who has gone through after school programs and worked in after school programs, I understand that completely. So let's talk about some of the other instances of Project 2025 as it relates to education, cutting minority-based scholarships, grants, or programs based on the project's definition of DEI for higher ed institutions. How would this affect you in your position at UB?
Yeah, so quite honestly, I can't draw a connection to how it would impact me. My role as Assistant Dean of Community Relations for Graduate School of Education is to connect the community to the university and the university to the community. It does not say the black and brown parts of the community. It does right. not say, you know, the other, you know, it's the entire community. And my view of the community is the whole picture of the community. It's made up of different races, ethnicities, cultures, and what have you. So technically speaking, it shouldn't impact it. But once again, we get to this speculation of, well, if it does, if Project 2025 is somehow enacted, what happens long term as folks start to challenge definitions? It's like, oh, well, actually in this role, we've looked at the numbers and Will is actively engaging these communities more often than these other communities. Therefore, there's an equity there, talking about the definition of DEI from the Project 2025 perspective. Then maybe we get a challenge that says that's not equitable.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to talk about the ripple effect. So my position, And I commend the Graduate School of Education at UB for creating a position as mine, creating as one of the pillars for how the Graduate School of Education is run as mutually beneficial community engagement. I commend them for that because it actually aligns with a lot of national and federal funding bodies who state within the grant opportunities that no longer will those seeking grants be able to add on a community partner at the tail end of the ideation of the grant proposal. These funding bodies have requested that those who are seeking grant funding must show a demonstrated connection and collaborative relationship with the community partners that are named in the grant.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, let's speculate. Let's imagine if the majority of those grants have been awarded to grantees who have included communities of color at a disproportionate rate. Then what happens to that strategy? What happens to that, you know, approach? I think it's pretty significant. And once again, this is only recently that these attitudes have been adopted by these funding bodies. This is only recently, less than 10 years. So in less than 10 years, when we make an inch of, an inch towards an inch in the direction of more equitable practices, we already see them being attacked in a really organized manner.
Mm-hmm.
But there's historical precedent for this.
Where could you see pushback to the Project 2025? If certain principles of the project move into the implementation stage, if Trump is elected, as an example, the funding or eliminating the Federal Department of Education, where would you see pushback? Where would that come from?
You mean how what would the counter look like?
Yeah.
Well, so I think that's the interesting thing. And I mentioned it earlier. You have to acknowledge the effort to organize. You have to acknowledge the fact that Donald Trump lost in that second election. And then there was a coming together mm-hmm. of people who said, nah, you know what? We need to come up with a plan and a strategy so that we implement. I think that this is a showing of a hand. And whether Donald Trump wins or loses, Project 2025 and its ideologies will persist.
Right.
So the question becomes, what is the collective strategy of those who oppose Project 2025 wholly or partly? What is the strategy to create a counter? What is a strategy to say to those who say, oh, well, this is an attack on democracy? What is the strategy to organize those individuals in a way that parallels the organization of Project 2025?
Yeah. And as we mentioned, you know, Project 2025 is not Trump dependent. It takes all it would take really is a Republican majority in the House and Senate for the project's initiatives to move forward. And it also, you know, as we talked about with organization, there could be infiltration or filtration at lower levels of government. So that is the plan. That is the organized plan. So Project 2025 is a roadmap for any conservative politician with political aspirations. I guess where do we go from here as a nation?
That reminds me of Martin Luther King's book. his last book. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'll lift that up. If we talk about being American citizens, and one of the responsibilities of being an American citizen, regardless of what subgroups or ideologies you hold on to, is political participation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now we're kind of stuck in this notion that political participation is just voting. And even more so, political participation is just voting in a presidential election. I think right now, if we look at Project 2025, that should be a signal that other communities need to organize in a way that addresses their political concerns and then find like-minded individuals where they can come across party lines, ideological lines to connect on things that they feel strongly about. I mean, that's grassroots as it gets.
You work with a lot of college students, obviously. What are they telling you?
So it's interesting. So right now we're hiring for a very important program, Brainy Bulls. I got to give a quick shout out for Brainy Bulls. It's a 5th through 12th grade virtual tutoring program in which we hire UB students, undergrad, graduate students to provide one-on-one tutoring supports. And so, of course, I'm coming in contact with a lot of young individuals. And I think it was the day of the debate. And through the interview, there was a moment where I'm talking to a student and we started to talk about the debate, and I asked if they were going to tune in, and this student said that they would not. I'm like, oh, well, why wouldn't you tune in? And this student was very perceptive and well aware. She's like, well, I don't think that there's any reason for me to tune in, because I think what's going to happen is that Kamala will best him in that format. Mm-hmm. But what she was most concerned about is, but by her besting him, will she tell us about her strategies to address concerns about Israel, Palestine, concerns about inflation, concerns about housing? And, you know, as I watched the debate, of course, people my age and older tuned in to see a veteran prosecutor do what she does best, and that's win a discussion. And I think she did an excellent job of that. But I thought about that student and what that student said, and I'm like, you know, I really did not hear any of the concrete strategies that this student would be looking for to sway their vote. Now, the student confided in me who she would vote in, and mm-hmm. she's like, I'm going to do it. But it was not a ecstatic, choice.
Do you feel, when meeting with students, if you ever talk about politics with them, that there's a general apathetic feeling amongst them?
Not at all. And I think, you know, apathetic is such it's kind of dismissive, because mm-hmm. it says, oh, they don't care.
Right.
So in that sense, absolutely not. Whether they vote or not, I think, is a different thing. Mm-hmm. But they are absolutely concerned. I mean, we've been there. Even if we weren't college students, we've been at that age where we're right at this impasse of childhood and young adulthood to becoming an adult and worrying about the things that adults have to worry about. And they are very concerned about their future, very concerned about their future. But I think what I do see in them is a bit of concern about how the system works for their benefit, and their participation in the system and how it turns into something that can alleviate their fears for the future. They are not apathetic at all. They speak about political issues a lot and passionately, but I think that they are not disillusioned by what seems to be a historical lack of accountability for individuals when they put in that vote and they get what they have asked for and have been promised after the election has subsided.
Good point. Good points all around. This has been What's Next, our special discussion on Project 2025. I want to thank my guest, Will Green, from the University at Buffalo. We'll be back with more What's Next after this.
Hey, people. I'm Corey, and this is Compact Civics. One thing about me, I love voting. Voting for pizza over wings, going to this movie or that. What I love most is casting my vote in an election.
What's one vote when so many people vote?
My vote doesn't really count. Can one vote really make a difference?
All right. I hear your doubts, but yes, it really can. Check this out. In 2002, a police officer in Washington State was running for the primary in the State House of Representatives. Out of nearly 12,000 votes, he came up one vote short. And here's the kicker. A fellow officer and friend, possibly former friend, forgot to mail in his ballot and left it sitting on his kitchen counter next to his water bill and half-eaten toast. Also in 2002, Esmeralda County in Nevada held an election for commissioner. It ended in a tie. And in the most Nevada thing ever, the tie was broken by having the candidates pick the highest card from a deck of playing cards. And right here in Western New York, the town supervisor election in Barry in Orleans County came down to a narrow 5-vote difference. There are more than 2,000 people in Barry, and only 600 people voted. So you see, one is not the loneliest number. It can be one of the most powerful numbers when it comes to our democracy.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. Continuing our conversation, maybe branching off just a little bit in terms of elections, but we have three experts when it comes to talking about misinformation and the use of misinformation, not only in elections, but in society in general. With us from UB Center for Information Integrity, the co-director, David Castillo. David, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Also with us, Jasmina Tachavas. Jasmina, visiting professor in the Department of Operations Management and Strategy, UB. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And E. Bruce Pittman is with us. Dr. Pittman, professor in the Department of Materials Design and Innovation. And if we check to chat GPT, we could find out that he has all sorts of other other titles as well. Thanks for joining us, professor.
Good to be with you.
All right, I'll just open up the conversation. Let's actually start about an event that's going on tonight that the Center for Information Integrity. A movie's coming up, a film called Coded Bias.
That's right.
I know a little bit about what this the background is, but why don't you describe it? Because I think it does not just talk about, it doesn't necessarily strike elections necessarily, but it does show you how a lot of the technology that we are utilizing and relying on and are becoming very comfortable with can be tremendously misleading.
That is absolutely correct. So Coded Bias is the first movie of a film series that CIA has put together for this fall. It'll be aired tomorrow at 5:30, Caping Hall 310 at UB. Following the screening of the film, we will have a discussion featuring my colleagues here who have been generous enough to come from different parts of New York State to join us. And what we are hoping to accomplish here is to have a broad conversation about the ethical implications of our use of AI, particularly in areas of a great deal of importance in public life. So AI ethics, AI equity, AI justice, these are some of the concerns that the center has. And we hope that the film series in general, but Coded Bias in particular, can get us to have a meaningful, broad conversation about these issues from different perspectives. As you know, CII is a center featuring now more than 40 professors from RES, spreading all the way from computer science and engineering, social sciences, the law school, medical school, the libraries, and humanities and art. And we are hoping that the films can serve as a hinge for all of us to have to share an experience that can lead to kinds of conversations, multidisciplinary conversations that we need in order to be aware of the ethical implications of our use of AIs in public life. My colleagues here will tell you a bit more about how Coded Bias accomplishes this. But generally speaking, the film is if I remember correctly, is a 2020 film. Right. Featuring an MIT student who discovers that the facial recognition resources that she has access to in AI, in the AI world, do not recognize her face. Hmm. And that leads her in a journey to understand the bias that are coded into not just facial recognition AIs, but other AIs more broadly. I will let my colleagues here explain a little bit more about Coded Bias in particular.
Yeah, so Jasmina, what about that? I mean, you're going to be on the panel discussion. You don't necessarily know exactly how the conversation is going to go, but what are the key points or at least key subjects of discussion that you want to bring?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most important points that the film makes, and I think this is underpinning the entire film series initiative at CII to begin with, is the idea of spreading what I would refer to as AI awareness. I don't really like the term AI literacy because it kind of implies that there might be people that are ill or non-literate, which I don't think is the case with technology, because even if we're not directly using it, it impacts all of us. So coming back to this idea of AI awareness, I think it's really important in today's day and age when more of the decisions that not only we make about our lives, but what institutions use, and pretty much in many different walks of life, as David already pointed out, are becoming increasingly automated. And so it's really important for everyone to know how these decisions get to be made and what types of recourse we might have as ordinary citizens when it comes to these systems. And another important point of the film, I think, which for me personally, because I'm really deeply invested in the history of women, particularly women of color, women with immigration backgrounds in technology, how this history has unfolded and the contributions of these communities to the development of technology. I think the film illustrates this really well because it was made by a director who's an immigrant and a woman. It features the MIT researcher who has subsequently become a doctor. So she's now a book author in her own right, Joy Bolanwini. She just published a book called Unmasking AI last year, kind of based on her story that the movie kind of follows. And many of the participants in the film itself are women, and particularly women of color. And I think it's important to point that out because this is precisely a key aspect of the movement for ethical AI, justice in AI, and all that. They have been driven specifically by women, especially women of color.
And, you know, it's interesting when it comes to the Center for Information Integrity. You know, David, I know that this is something that you brought up way back when you were getting first involved in this, that this is going to be a multidisciplinary approach to this. And so for you, Dr. Pittman, you're a mathematician. So you can see in some ways when it comes to algorithms and things along those lines that are involved with AI, you most certainly can, I guess, see a connection there. But I want to maybe get your perspective. As we heard from Jasmina, which she thinks is a key element of this. How about for you?
I think there's two points really at play here. One is these algorithms, in particular the algorithms that underlie the film, we don't understand how they work when it comes down to it.
And if you say that, I totally believe it.
Just really don't understand. Right. These algorithms are non-explainable. You can't tell why it makes certain decisions at certain times. And so the answers at the end of the day, we're not quite sure how you got there.
Right.
Okay, well, you know, the film underlies facial recognition and facial recognition getting something wrong. Well, I can't remember every face that I've ever seen, and I don't know who that is necessarily. We get things wrong.
That's, right.
But there is this aura of computers as being infallible, and the algorithm said, and therefore it's sort of written in stone coming down from Mount Sinai, that it must be correct and you can't question it. The film, I think, brings out the fallacy of that kind of mentality. We have to be able to question these AI systems. Second point is related to that. There's not a responsible individual who is ultimately, say, making a decision or someone to whom you can ask for recourse because the algorithm made a bad decision. You can't appeal. How do you appeal to a computer?
Right, right.
And so all of these things are caught up in the film, and I think those questions are issues that we need to understand quite generally as a society. We need to get our lawmakers to sort of learn something and to start acting, particularly in this country. I think Europe is a little ahead of us in some of this, our lawmakers need to, we need to engage the political process so that our lawmakers understand the wonderful possibilities of AI and the gobsmacking failures that it also brings to us.
Interesting that you mentioned lawmakers and such. We have an election upon us. Very rapidly approaching that, and I thought it was interesting to hear how you said Europe, Dr. Pittman, is ahead of the United States. But what about, are there concerns right now that just stick out to you as we go into these final weeks of the election? Or are we already, I mean, there's not going to be any legislative change between now and the second Tuesday in November when it comes to election day. But what should people maybe, are there some pitfalls that we should be keeping an eye out for as we get closer to election day?
So from the perspective of our members at the Center for Information Integrity, the key contribution we feel we can make has to do essentially with two different ways of exposing and combating misinformation, disinformation. One would fall under the general category of debunking. So we do have experts, my co-director Siwei Lu, my partner in crime here, is an expert in deepfake detection. So his lab, Deepfake-O-Meter, can let you know whether a particular piece of audio or an image or a video has been altered. And so that's part of this, of what we would call the debunking approach. Now, the question here is has to do with the fact that even when you red flag a particular type of media as inauthentic or manipulative in some way, by the time you do this, these are essentially forensic methods. By the time you do this, the damage is already done. And even sometimes when you red flag something, that gets that particular product more views.
So that has
to be part of the answer, but not the only answer. So the other aspect, let's say the other piece of our approach, our combined approach, has to do with what I would call pre-banking. So anticipating the kinds of patterns that certain types of manipulative information, false misleading information, might fall under, and incorporate that understanding of patterns into a broadly conceived media literacy training approach to, say, community conversations. So we follow these two different approaches, understanding that how we can help community conversations happen between not just within the university, but across all sectors of public life. In whichever way we can do that, we can contribute to that. We feel that we are approaching this problem without falling into the trap of claiming for ourselves the Ministry of Truth status.
Right, okay.
Which would be quite dangerous.
Right, right. Let me turn to you for a second, Professor Pittman. And just from your travels through what the landscape is right now, and in terms of the election, I mean, are you seeing misinformation at a certain type of level? Is it something that's popping out to you? You see this, that, and the other thing, or getting reports? I'm kind of curious about your position or what you see on that.
I've seen misinformation in many places. And I think the heart of what David was suggesting here is the need for us as a public to educate ourselves in how to understand, how to view what is shown to you. It's a new way of thinking for us as we interact with computer images, computer video, computer audio images, tapes. Does it make sense to us? Does this fit into other things we know? Does it pass the smell test? We as a society, I think, need to develop a set of tools to learn and to be able to engage the media quite generally and ask ourselves, how does this fit in? Does it seem to make sense to us? So each of us individually, I think, has that responsibility. And it's not something that's taught in school, unfortunately.
Right, no.
We didn't learn it in high school or elementary school nowadays. I think we need, as a society, to think about this a little bit and actually get it into the curriculum, right, to raise awareness. Mm-hmm. For young people.
And I'm interested in Jasmina from your perspective, just because before we went on the air, we realized that you were just becoming a naturalized U.S. citizen. Congratulations on that. And this will be your first chance to vote in the United States. How are you getting your information? You're a scholar. I mean, I know you're well versed in many things, but it's interesting because here you are now. You're one of us. You're being bombarded with messages and such. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
That's right. And thank you so much once again. It's interesting because I'm not just studying these things, obviously. I also use social media myself. And I've been spending a lot of time on Instagram, for example, Twitter, now X, definitely, a little bit Facebook. And I know, especially my students, they spend a lot of time on TikTok. And across all of these platforms, regardless of what the original intention of their creators was, they are being used for the spread of political information. They have different policies. Now, granted, some of them are more strict about, for instance, political advertising than others. The ones operated by Meta do allow that, which has not been the case on other platforms, for example. So you can pay in order to share political news with not just your followers, but with a segment of the population that's kind of described by the demographic criteria that you're interested in. And there is a lot of research being done on how these political ads target people. And these are not really individuals, to my understanding. They're more of like baskets of specific demographic characteristics. So if you check these boxes, chances are you will be exposed to a particular message. So we know a little bit about how different political campaigns are targeting people on social media. If I'm allowed to share some of that research, it's coming out of Syracuse University, the School of Information Studies, where I'm an assistant professor. They research specifically, for example, shows that the Trump campaign is targeting fewer women than the Harris campaign. So there's interesting, you know, demographic differences and nuances when it comes to how you reach the potential voters.
And all very intentional.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really mind-boggling that social media does give you, a lot of it is through the use of AI, but that they give you the opportunity to do this kind of really segmented and targeted approach to reach potential voters. And a lot of this, as my colleagues have already said, is not easy to vet. It's not easy to establish who the regulating body will be in terms of discovering inequities or deep fake material and all that. So to your original question, it is difficult to navigate the social media landscape right now. And we're kind of doing research on this, and it's still difficult sometimes to figure out how exactly these systems work. To Bruce's point, they are specifically made to be opaque in a lot of these cases. And so we do need to exercise a lot of caution. And I do want to mention, though, it doesn't take a really sophisticated deep fake to do the job of misleading potential voters. It can be a really low-tech approach as well. And we've been seeing this, so there's nothing new about it. I think our job right now is to just consolidate our knowledge and expertise from across these different fields, not just them, but also beyond, because in the humanities and social studies in general, there has been a lot of research on this potential swaying of opinions for decades. So it's a matter of really consolidating this.
And David, tonight, of course, part of your film series is going on. This is called Coded Bias. Starts at 5:30?
5:30 to 8 is the length of the event. Okay. And that includes the conversation that will be driven by these two conductors here.
You're washing your hands of that, I say. Okay, very good.
I'm just a convener.
So it's like 5:30 to 8, Capen 310.
Capen Hall 310.
310. And, back in your days when you were at the Humanities Institute, there was always refreshments at the end of these events. Is that still the case?
Yes, we will have pizza and soft drinks.
Okay, very good. And everybody's welcome.
Everybody's welcome.
And hopefully for a good turn. Our guests here on What's Next, Debbie Castile, the co-director of the UB Center for Information Integrity, E. Bruce Pittman, professor in the Department of Materials Design and Innovation, also Jasmina Tacheva, who is the visiting professor in the Department of Operations Management and Strategy at the University of Buffalo. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.